Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the House Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for March 26, 2025 to order. A quorum is present, so we will get started. We have a full agenda today, so if everyone can keep their testimonies brief, that would be great. And the first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Let's see. Representative Cagle, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I will move the minutes.
So Chair Cagle moves approval of the minutes for March 26, 2025. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? I'm sorry,
24.
26.
The minutes for
March 24th. Oh, so the minutes for March 24th. Thank you. So I move approval of the minutes for March 24th, 2025. And I see that Chair Cagle has a bill to present. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1520 to the General Register. This is the DPS policy bill. What it does is it moves the name change statutes into a different section. I do have a technical amendment, the A1 amendment. If we could adopt that one, please. I will move the A1 amendment for adoption.
Great. And would you like to describe your amendment?
It's a technical amendment, renumbering the sections and changing a couple of shalls to musts.
Any discussion from members on the A1 amendment? Seeing no further discussion of the A1 amendment, Chair Cagle renews her motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. And Chair Cagle, please tell us about your bill.
Again, it's just moving some name change requirements to the proper section of statute. If there's any questions, we do have Director Zhang here for questions.
Thank you. Great. And we have one testifier signed up in advance. So after we hear from those folks, we will allow members of the public to testify on the bill. So first up, we have Pang Zhang, Director of DVS.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pang Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Thank you, Rep. Cagle, for authoring this policy bill. It is very technical in nature, and it doesn't change anything in DVS processes. It just clarifies a statute to match what we already do today. Last year, we had a large piece of legislation that moved rules into statute, and in that shift, this piece around the name change documents got put under the identity document section. It really belongs in its own section around name changes, not under identity documents. Again, not a process change for DVS. And then the second part of this bill is a clarification on manslaughter when there's a vehicle involved. And DVS recently had to overturn one of our revocations due to a court case. And that court had some, there was not clear language around the difference between manslaughter and a CVO CVH. This clarifies that manslaughter kind of stands on its own and should rectify that issue going forward. So that revocations related to manslaughter's work with the vehicle, the same revocation applies to across the board. Again, both no changes to actual DVS process, just clarification and statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Zhang.
Are there any other members of the public that would like to testify on the bill?
Sorry. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify? If not, we will move to member questions. Are there any members who would like to testify? Or, I'm sorry, comment on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Chair Kosnick?
I believe the motion is to send this to the General Register, correct?
Yes, that's my understanding, yes.
I support that motion.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Chair Cagle renews her motion that HF 1520, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion passed.
Next up is Representative Jones, House File 1509. The motion is to lay over for possible inclusion. Rep. Jones, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present this bill today. I'm excited to present this common sense bill to appropriately right-size government in our lives as we move on our streets and reserve public safety resources for our most pressing needs. Every one of us is a pedestrian at some point in the day. As humans, we are hardwired to want to conserve energy, and as modern busy people, we want to save time. As an example, just this morning, I saw a neighbor access her car, which was parked on the opposite side of the street from her home, by crossing the block. However, this is an enforceable illegal act of jaywalking. I've talked about this to my community members at a number of meetings in my district, and every time I ask who has jaywalked before, every single hand goes up. If literally everyone is breaking the law and subject to enforcement, I think something is fundamentally wrong. The law is just not appropriately targeted. And I refuse to believe that every Minnesotan is a criminal. Thinking adults should be able to safely cross the street without fear of penalty. Jaywalking has been against the law in Minnesota for about 100 years. It was enacted at a time when cars and pedestrians were new to one another. This law, however, has not recognized or adjusted to take into account real situations, such as roads that don't have sidewalks or impassable sidewalk situations, which one of my testifiers will speak to. And who enforces these penalties? Well, our law enforcement. Today, though, demands on our law enforcement officers have increased, and our resources are being stretched. In fact, many law enforcement officers are no longer enforcing this law. Few are ticketing the person crossing Main Street to just run into the post office or the donut shop. There are other safety issues in higher need of their attention. This bill, House File 1509, decriminalizes three forms of jaywalking. First, it limits the issuance of citations for entering a roadway to cross during a steady yellow or red light. Two, it limits citations when entering a crosswalk with the flashing don't walk pedestrian signal. Three, it limits citations for crossing a roadway between operating signals. What it does not do, though, is limit law enforcement's ability to investigate or charge people in the case of a safety incident, hazard, or criminal liability. And I've only been in this committee for a short period of time, but I know this committee cares about safety. Luckily, there is some data available to this end. According to the Governor's Highway Safety Association, three states have decriminalized jaywalking, including some purpley states of Virginia and Nevada. If safety truly had been compromised with the removal of such a law, we'd see a marked increase in pedestrian fatalities, but the data just hasn't shown that. In conclusion, this is an easy choice. You can choose between a law that is rarely followed or enforced, or you can choose to let people use their common sense to decide if it is safe to cross the street. I suggest that it is common sense to not cross when a car is coming, and we don't need a law to tell us that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jones. I see we have two testifiers. First up is Michael Wojcik. Did I say that correctly? All right. Sorry about that. And then Bryce Maples will be on deck. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Michael Wojcik. I am the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, and I come before you today as a hardened criminal, frequently and knowingly in violation of the law and repeating it quite often. In fact, every time I go up to Hibbing, Minnesota, where my mother lives, and visit the Sunrise Bakery, I park on the opposite side of First Avenue and knowingly violate the law by walking into their front door. So keep in mind, in the back of your mind as I testify today, that you are in fact listening to a criminal trying to justify his crimes. I would ask all of you who have jaywalked to raise your hand. However, I respect your constitutional right against self-incrimination, so I'm not going to do that. This really is a common sense proposal, and that's something Senator Jasinski said himself, that this is common sense, and the bottom line is do you need government to tell you how to cross a street? I would posture that the answer is no to that. And here's what's counterintuitive about the jaywalking laws as they exist. In a number of circumstances, the jaywalking laws, if strictly followed, actually make people less safe. And we're seeing that borne out in data here in the state of Minnesota. We know that serious crashes tend to happen at intersections. It's something that the Advisory Council on Traffic Safety, of which I'm part of, has looked into. And the reality is crossing a roadway when there is no car coming mid-block is safer than crossing at an intersection when you're relying on the compliance of a potentially distracted driver at that intersection. But for people with disabilities, it's even more challenging. Oftentimes, as you know, in the winter, snow tends to get piled up in the corners, and the very places that we're directing people to cross become the least passable. Now, we've discussed this before, and we tried to bring this forward in a way that was understanding of the potential challenges that law enforcement have, and we've had conversations with both the Department of Public Safety and the police chiefs. We see that the police chief sent a note opposing this, and we hope to continue working with them. The Department of Public Safety is not opposed, so law enforcement is divided in their take on what this bill would be. But what's particularly frustrating for us is we've reached out to the and met with the chiefs and sent a follow-up email to try and have ongoing discussions, and we just haven't heard anything back. And so to see this letter was disappointing to us. But if their goal is safety and our goal is safety, we're confident and we can come up with a solution that meets all of our needs. And, finally, what I would say is that every community is a little bit different, and trying to come up with a statewide law is very difficult. So what we would simply say is let's trust the ability of people to know how to cross the street safely on their own. If they're doing something that's unsafe, the law still has the same rights for law enforcement to address that they do today. So I would encourage you all to support this common sense measure that will bring laws into compliance with people's practices and make me less of a hardened criminal.
Thank you. Is there any additional? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Maples. Welcome to the committee. If you have any, or please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Bryce Maples. I live in Long Park, Minnesota. Please let me know if you can hear me with this mic. I want to touch more on what the previous testimony talked about with people with disabilities. As you can see, I am pretty obviously in a wheelchair, and I will note that this wheelchair is top of the line as far as wheelchair goes. It costs about $60,000, if you will believe that. It's taken me years to get this wheelchair from the insurance company, and yet I can't really go through much snow. I have the best case scenario as far as mobility devices being able to get through snow. Our elders who are forced to use scooters and other folks using manual wheelchairs are in much worse shape. Despite this, I am functionally a hermit during the winter. I can't drive because of my disability. I rely on public transportation. Metro Mobility does not cut it due to lack of funding, and they just don't show up when I need them to show up. So if I need to get around by myself, I have to use sidewalks. In the winter, those are, as previously stated, the curb cuts, the part where I am directed to use. 9 times out of 10, unless I'm in a very populated area of downtown Minneapolis, that curb cut is blocked. I cannot use it. However, people tend to clear their driveways because they use their driveways, and it's their responsibility. And also Anyway, they clear their driveways. So I often utilize these driveways to enter streets and exit streets to avoid blocked sidewalks. This is a crime. I am committing a crime by trying to get around as a person with a disability. I will add that this is not just an issue in the winter. Due to the lack of investment of our sidewalks, there are many sidewalks that are simply impassable year-round, which require me to enter the street, whether because of potholes in the sidewalk, lack of curb cuts, roots going up through the street, whatever it may mean. There are countless reasons that people like myself and others are forced to enter the right-of-way, and it should not be, I should not have to fear committing a crime in order to go about my daily business.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public that are wishing to testify on this piece of legislation? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see in front of us today we got a bill talking about jaywalking, and they said there's no fiscal impact to this. My question is if we're bringing a bill like this forward, I'm assuming that there's been a lot of tickets wrote or like people that are worried of the tickets and how much revenue we've generated at the law enforcement centers or what we're seeing. What's the number of tickets that have been wrote for this?
I don't know if anybody in the room would be able to answer that, but that might be something that DPS can follow up with offline. Any other questions? Representative Anderson? Oh, sorry, Representative Joy.
Thank you. So I guess with me, you know, I see this bill moving forward. I understand the intent of it, but, you know, to me, we have two letters sitting here that the Minnesota Police Officer Association, and they oppose this language. And I understand we've tried reaching out to them, working with them, but when we bring things forward, we should have all the players at the table. And it worries me when we start taking tools out of their toolbox and we're going to start limiting what police can do and what they can't do. You know, to me, I understand the contents of this bill, but with the looming deficit we have and what we have in front of us, this is probably not a priority bill we got to have. I'm glad it's being laid over and kept in the committee, but that's all I have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. And I also commit this crime regularly, so, and I don't think we should necessarily have laws in the books that people ignore. But I'm glad that the author is willing to work with the law enforcement and see if we can come to some sort of resolution. So mm-hmm. as we work on laying this over. So thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is that, you know, what if there's an accident? Who's liable? If all of a sudden you jump out in front of a car, is the car now liable because you have every right to be crossing in the middle of the street?
Mr. Wojak?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for that question. That is actually something that we specifically focused on and how this was prepared, that the ability to do this necessitates you're not doing so in an unsafe way. So in the case where you're actually moving in front of a vehicle, there is no difference in the law than there is today. You still have the liability being on the person who's causing the accident in this case. So we understood that that was going to be a concern, and we specifically wanted to make sure that was still covered under the law should this pass.
And if I may add, I would not be carrying a bill.
Representative Jones?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Murphy. Yeah, I would not be wanting to carry a bill that is intentionally creating an unsafe situation.
That's okay, thank you.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Jones. I did have a chance to speak to a few of my police chiefs, and like the testifier said, a little 50-50. Mm-hmm. But one of the questions I had for you is in your conversations in preparing for this bill, was there any difference in safety or language? I get it when it's a single person or a couple people or, you know, a group of two or three, but, you know, let's say you're, you know, at an Xcel Energy game or you're, you know, at a outdoor concert event, you've got these much larger groups of people that are running across causing an unsafe condition. Is there still an opportunity for law enforcement to address that somehow?
Representative Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Myers, thank you for the question. I would have to get back to you on that. I don't have a specific answer at this time.
Representative Kosnick.
I would just encourage members to take a look at the letters that are in here, one from the police chiefs, one from the Police Officers Association. The Police Officers Association says The inability to enforce existing law is clearly unsafe for pedestrians and officers. An officer's inability to address perceived dangers is highly problematic and makes communities less safe. The other one is from the police chiefs. They strongly oppose keeping traffic laws on the books that do not include enforcement and penalty clause provisions. We can only expect that there would be an increase in pedestrian crossings at uncontrolled locations. This would increase the risk of potential for pedestrians to be struck by motoring vehicles. And so I take the opinions of our police chiefs and police associations quite strongly, as they're the ones that enforce our laws, but also keep our community safe, whether there's a law on the books or not. And so would be opposed to the bill. And I think we shouldn't take lightly and make light of breaking the laws. And I don't believe it's an actual criminal statute. It's more of a citation that's discussed, that's current law. So I would oppose the bill.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but it just kind of occurred to me that we've heard discussions before about the increase in distracted driving, cell phones, you're messing with the radio, you're drinking something, like whatever, right? So when you considered this and you think about people just randomly at any point in time on any street, just crossing the street, not in a crosswalk per se, how do you figure distracted driving and frankly distracted pedestrians? Because I walk around these halls answering emails and texts and am lucky I have not caused some particular incident and scandal. So just in terms of both distracted driving and distracted pedestrians, what are your thoughts on that in terms of this bill? Thank you.
Representative Jones.
Madam Chair and Representative Berg, thank you for the question. So the point of this bill is to decriminalize those situations in which we know there's not a safety hazard, right? And so this is not the, I'm trying to run across really quick and I know that there's a car is coming. That is still illegal and that's what we're keeping in this bill. And so that that I think gets at this, okay, there's a car coming, whether they're distracted or not, we don't want someone running into the road in that situation.
Representative Berg? Okay. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jones, thank you for bringing this, you know, really thought-provoking bill. Actually, Representative Berg asked something that I think answered my question, although I have a comment afterwards, but I do want to point out or clarify that it would still be a violation if someone went jaywalked in an unsafe manner that put them in front of a car or something like that, right? So in some ways, this is narrowing the focus of our jaywalking statute. Is that the way to think about it?
Representative Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, that's correct.
Any follow-up?
Yeah.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, so, you know, we have a situation here where today, virtually all of us are breaking the law, and the police get to choose who they want to stop. With really, there's no guidance. I think they can do whoever they want. And I think that regardless of what kind of issues that raises, that does create some, I think, difficulty. Like, how does someone interpret what they're supposed to do? I really appreciate the comments from the police chief, so I'm not downplaying those, but I do see that this seems to be providing more focus to the statute so that it's more able to be enforced in a way that should improve safety and ensure no bias creeps into it. So I really appreciate the approach you're taking, and I would urge us to really consider this. It's a good discussion to have.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Any further member questions? Rep. Jones, if you would like to close.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members. Yeah, I really appreciate you this conversation. As has been mentioned, I'm really committed to working with law enforcement to find a way to make this work, so we can have more focused and just focused laws on our books, so that we're not all criminals.
Thank you, Reverend Jones. And I think, you know, every one of us has probably crossed the street where we weren't supposed to. And I've also seen members of this chamber, you know, run red lights and leave dog poop in a park. And so there's lots of stuff that we don't do properly. And I think this is one that just addresses one of those issues. So thank you. With that, Rep. Jones, would you like to renew your motion that House File 1509 be laid over for possible inclusion?
I renew my motion.
Bill is laid over. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we will move to Representative Ream. If you would like to go and... What is he? Oh, okay. Well, what bill then should we go for? Okay, yep, let's go ahead. Representative Ream, would you like to make the motion that House File 2249 be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, I would, Chair.
Thank you. Would you like to present your bill, please?
Yes, and then if I could also have a motion to amend the bill.
There is the A1. I'm sorry, I don't even have the bill. Okay, A1 amendment. Can you please explain what the amendment does?
Sure. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. So the amendment would change the maximum amount of the rebate, the very popular rebate, from $1,500 to $750. And this was done to make the rebate more available to people at a time when the cost of e-bikes are starting to go down. It also changes the eligibility requirements to receive a rebate. The current law, as it stands right now, allocates 40% of the rebate funding to go toward low-income individuals based on their adjusted gross income, and this amendment would change that to 100% of the eligible applicants would be of lower income. And then the third change, it gives the responsibility for designing and implementing the lottery system to the Commissioner of Revenue.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, to your bill, Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Cagle and members. Thank you for hearing this bill. So House File 2249 is a very simple bill. It basically makes some changes to the e-bike rebate program to make it more accessible. It was wildly popular, and we just want to make it more accessible to people. And last year when it was launched, it was on a first-come, first-served basis. And it proved that e-bikes are incredibly popular. And so we want to make it more accessible to people. A lot of people with computers were able to access the first-come, first-served basis you know, requirements. But for people who aren't that tech-savvy, they weren't able to access it. So we just want to make it so that it's more accessible to people. And I do have a number of testifiers here who can also talk about the bill.
All right, we will move to testifiers. I have Matt Moore, General Counsel for People for Bikes. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cagle and members of the committee. My name is Matt Moore. I am a Minneapolis resident for 40 years now, but I'm also blessed to serve as policy counsel for People for Bikes. We are the national trade association for the bicycle industry with about 300 members who make bicycles and e-bikes, including some members here in Minnesota, Quality Bicycle Products, and of course Park Tool, a company here in St. Paul. We are fully support this bill as we supported the original bill that was carried by Representative Ream. And as she's pointed out, moving to a lottery approach will enable all Minnesotans to apply for and obtain a rebate or at least enhance their ability to do so. The current application system with first-come, first-served approach led to difficulties with the online system when it was launched and is really akin to trying to get tickets to a Taylor Swift concert because the demand was really overwhelming. The bill would also require preparation and delivery of report to the legislature on the effectiveness of the rebate program and the processes that are used. This is important. At a recent e-bike summit sponsored by the University of Minnesota, we heard from individuals who are disabled, including they have vision impairments that prevent them from getting a driver's license, but they still need to get around their communities. A lottery approach will make it far easier for those people and for low-income individuals who really need this rebate the most to apply over a period of time and then have a fair chance to obtain a rebate. It won't just go to the swift-fingered folks on the computer. Of course, we feel electric bicycles are part of the future of mobility and recreation. They have a proven track record of reducing car trips, reducing congestion. Who doesn't want to reduce congestion? And they also expand these low-cost mobility options for individuals. While the retail price of e-bikes has been going down as the production numbers, the popularity has increased, you know, supply and demand, we are now faced with tariffs at the federal level that in some cases will increase the price of e-bikes by 70%. So this is, again, will be extremely important for Minnesotans who want to purchase an e-bike or need that for transportation to be able to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is Connor Higgins. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Connor Higgins, and I'm a lifelong non-driver who has never held a driver's license due to a combination of disability and finances. I rely on a combination of walking, public transit, and biking. Currently, that's a pedal bike. I've always held off on a gang e-bike because of the cost. This rebate program would help change that calculus. I use my bike for essential trips such as school, groceries, and that kind of thing, just as much as anyone would use a car. One of those is a Costco nearby. It would be 15 minutes by bike, 30 minutes by public transit, and about an hour's walk. Bike also provides the option of carrying back more stuff. That said, e-bikes are far more effective at that. My partner has an e-bike, and he demonstrates that every single trip. He has way less trouble with those trips than I ever do. And that also helps increase the accessibility of that form of transportation. And since I can use a pedal bike, but not everyone can, and that includes people who are aging out of driving. Almost everyone here knows somebody who is aging out of driving. There's no reason that their ability to live their life independently should stop when they stop driving. That should not be where the cutoff is. People need some form of option to get around. The car can't be the only one. This rebate program helps it bring one of the most accessible options to being accessible in terms of affordability as well as ability. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We also have Mr. Wojak on the agenda as well. If you would like to come up to the rostrum, reintroduce yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, I am still Michael Wojak, and as far as I know, still the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, speaking in favor of this bill. I do not want to repeat any of the points that have already been stated, and I know there's a competing bill that would do away with the program altogether. We do not believe that that is the proper path to take. We think that improving the program is particularly powerful, and this is a program that really benefits two groups of people who might not otherwise be able to access this technology, and that is, as you heard, people who are physically unable to drive, and then additionally, there's folks that are financially unable to drive. AAA estimates that about $13,000 a year is the is the average cost of owning a vehicle. And, you know, on top of housing, that can be a challenge for a lot of folks. The changes that we'd be looking at would be to ensure that the dollars in this program are directed to those most in need at the lower income levels, and would also make sure that there is a more reasonable process for accessing those funds than just trying to get online as quickly as possible. One of the really interesting things about the e-bike policy summit that we helped organize is just the benefits that communities are seeing from e-bikes, and one of those happens to be the very real change in the number of vehicle miles traveled once a household gets an e-bike for the first time. It's something that can actually have a financial impact, not only on individuals, but on how we design cities as well. And, you know, an aging population is something that this continues to be a good tool for. So we believe the changes in this program make it more effective, and that there is a purpose for these dollars in meeting transportation needs for the people that aren't always represented or front of mind when we think about transportation. As such, we support this bill and hope that it'll move forward.
Thank you. Is there any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Anderson. I had you. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Ream. Definitely some stuff in here. I appreciate the changes that were made. I'm not an e-bike expert. You know, four kids don't have, you know, we haven't gotten to the e-bike stage. But can you help me understand a little bit of exactly what's defined as an electric-assisted bike?
Mr. Wojcik?
And what I would say is this is also a great conversation for us, and I'm willing to have it with anyone one-on-one because it's not exactly easy. And, Madam Chair, members, it's not an easy question to answer. We have some very specific legislation, and we feel that Minnesota is actually on the cutting edge in terms of what is and is not. Representative Myers, I know particularly in your district there have been problems with vehicles that are absolutely not e-bikes. They're generally speaking, if you can go faster than 20 miles per hour without pedaling, it's not an e-bike. If it's really powerful, it's not an e-bike. And if you can go faster than 28 even pedaling, it's not an e-bike. And we do see a lot of problems with those. In Minnesota, we try to specifically limit what is an e-bike so that it can be treated like a bicycle. And even though our laws are in place, that doesn't necessarily mean the awareness is in place as well. And a little bit of an aside, but we as an organization are working on a program, and we've offered to meet with community leaders, particularly in the West Metro, because that's where we hear it the most. You know, the squeaky wheel, right? we are planning on offering training to law enforcement or communities about what is and is not an e-bike and the tools that already exist to help address e-bike issues. And that includes just making everyone aware that if you're not 15, you can't be on any kind of e-bike whatsoever in Minnesota.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. You know, and I appreciate that. You know, I've heard from testimony and other people that maybe there's a little bit more focus on the purpose of this, either because of age or, you know, physical well-being. Representative Ream, as the bill author, have you considered to make this a little more narrow to even focus on those people?
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Thank you, Representative Myers. I have thought about it a little bit. If you'd like to discuss that further, we could. I know... Yeah, these are very popular with an aging population. It's very popular with people who have limited mobility, people who are neurodiverse, who don't drive. You know, they really like the e-bikes and can benefit from them. I mean, it's certainly worth considering, and I would be happy to discuss that with you.
Okay. Representative Myers?
Two more questions, sorry. No, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. And then there's a report in here. Just the reason for the report?
Representative Ream.
So I'm looking at the report right now here. Give me a moment. Thank Thank you, Chair Cagle. I don't have the report in my packet here. There's a letter. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, the letter from People for Bikes.
Representative Ream, I believe.
Oh, sorry.
You said, can you refer to the line, please, Representative Myers?
Yeah, just starting on 2.13, we just talk about the reporting from the commissioner.
I believe we deleted section one and replaced it with the A1 amendment. Is that correct, Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, members, yes, section one is the part of the statutory language for the e-bike rebate program. Section two remains as part of the underlying bill, and that's the section that directs the Commissioner of Revenue to submit a report and outlines some of the contents that's required in that.
And
Representative Myers.
The reason I ask that is the intent, the author's intent to make this an ongoing, program.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Myers. It's an extremely popular program, so I think in the future it's certainly something worth considering, given how it has been very helpful for people who don't drive. And when we think about Department of Transportation, we're thinking about not just roads and cars, but we're also thinking about multimodal transportation. So I would certainly consider that. But right now, as it stands, it's just these past 2 years, we are this year and last year, we have the rebate program already set up. So, and I know Michael Wojcik would also be willing to talk about the report that we did add to the bill, having the commission produce a report at the end of the year.
And thank you, Representative Ream. This was one-time funding from the 2023 appropriation. Is that correct, Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. One more. Okay.
Yep. Kind of close it up. Transportation is really important. I mean, I think, even Senator Dibble talked about we got to make some, we got to prioritize certain things. And, we've heard a lot of testimony in this committee about, making sure those dollars go as far as possible. I'd like to give some, strong consideration to, being able to provide those services that have the biggest impact to people, if that's Metro Mobility, if that's Southwest Transit. Those things can go a long way versus, a grant program like this. But I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Myers. I think what this does is help solve that last mile problem. I think that's one of the biggest barriers. So Representative Scrubba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. One of the comments before was because of the tariffs, the bikes are going to go up in price. And quite honestly, I bought a bike, e-bike. I own a Rad Rover built in Seattle and promoting America, the whole thing. And my cousin lives in Seattle and I go over there and they're everywhere. But there's also those, quote, pesky foreign bikes that are $5,000 and $6,000 and $10,000. And they're expensive. And I have clients that use them. And I'm just, I'm struggling with the fact that we're trying to get people to buy down, government is trying to buy down the price of a bike for what's the end result here. I mean, I hear there's people that this is their mode of operandi, but we don't buy cars down. We don't buy the other expensive pedal bikes down, the ultra lightweight ones. I'm curious why this. Just thank you.
Representative Ream.
So thank you, Chair Cagle, and thank you for the question, Representative Scrubba. And I just wanted to address the Metro Mobility comment. For people who are disabled, you can use Metro Mobility. It's just not that easy. I don't know if you've ever ridden on one, but it's a lot more difficult. You have to arrange the ride beforehand. You have to wait for the person to pick you up. It's not as easy as riding a bike. And it is a tool for getting to school and to work. So I think it is, I think there's a certain percentage of Minnesotans who don't drive. They won't ever drive. They might not be able to drive. They might not be able to afford a car. But I think that's really important to think about. And then in terms of what kind of bikes we're selling or what kind of bikes we have in this program, We did work on the language to make sure that we are working with certain vendors in Minnesota, but I think Mike Wojak would do a really great job of explaining that better than I can right now.
Mr. Wojak, please, quickly, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, there are a number of domestic options. I think one thing to keep in mind with this is that if you can ride a two-pedal standard e-bike, which most people can, but a lot of people can't, folks particularly within the disabled community and those with some balance issues just due to age typically need more of a trike-type model. So I've heard the comments that you can go get a, you know, $400 e-bike at Walmart or something like that. You're getting what you pay for on that. And a lot of times these actually don't even qualify as e-bikes under Minnesota law because of the quality of the components. So when you actually get into the bike that some of these people need for reliability and getting around, those costs are quite a bit higher, and they are coming down. One thing we didn't mention is this drops from a maximum of $1,500 to $750, and that's because the cost of a quality bike is going down as well. I'll stop it there because you asked me to be brief.
Thank you, and I think, you know, one of the things that this bill does is make sure that we're getting the rebates to income-qualified people. And so, you know, this is a way for folks to get to school, to get to work, to get to their jobs, and they're low-income individuals and couples. Representative Sensimira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I originally raised my hand when Representative Myers was speaking because I want to say that if you want to do an amendment to make this funding ongoing, I would, you know, wholeheartedly support that. This was an incredibly, you know, popular program with my constituents, and thank you, Representative Ream, for the work that you've done to deal with some of the bumps that I know happened. You know, one of the things that I think is striking is that we have, you know, data that shows us that about 1% of the population of Minnesota was looking at the website when it was going live. I mean, that is really shocking to me. That shows just how popular this is. You know, I think that this is a really makes a lot of sense. I think there's definitely a lot of constituents in my community who recognize that the amount of driving that we are doing is not good for the planet and are looking into different alternatives. And I think focusing this kind of rebate on the folks that might not be able to afford an e-bike otherwise makes a lot of sense to me. But I think this program has been incredibly popular. I think it shows that it's working, and I would certainly, you know, be interested in making it ongoing funding if there's, you know, appetite for that on the other side. Thank you.
Representative Fogelman.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. I think that you have really good intentions with this bill, and I get that, but I think the cloud in the room is that we are looking at a $6 billion deficit in our state, and that's not going away. The governor just had cuts to education, $180 million that affects teacher pay, special education. I think a school in your district, Representative Ream, is looking at cutting $5 million for the 25-26 budget and another $4 million for 26-27. These are cuts that are going to hurt teachers, make our classroom sizes larger, and hurt special education. We just have to rein in our spending here, and we have to look at wants versus needs. That, like I said, that $6 billion deficit, we have to look at reallocating, I think, $2 million for this program, maybe into roads and bridges, maybe into better bus routes, something that makes a little bit more sense, that helps more people and not just a few. If you think that this is the best way to spend, do you think that this rebate for $2 million for bikes is the best way to spend $2 million in our city right now?
Well, thank you, Representative Fogelman. I would mention that this is already appropriated money, so it's not anything that's going to be taken out of our budget or general fund money. This was already appropriated. And so I think you raise some fair points, but luckily in transportation, we have our own funding sources, and so we are looking at cutting general fund revenue from our budget, but we still have other sources of money that we can backfill some of that spending with that are dedicated to transportation. And so I don't think it's really, you know, this was money that was already appropriated. Representative Ream.
Chair Cagle, and thank you, Representative. I know a lot of people have talked about this bill as being a bill to subsidize a luxury item. Well, I would say that many people who don't drive would not consider this to be a luxury item. This is a tool to get to school and work. We do a lot of subsidizing in this state for roads and bridges. We subsidize parking lots. We don't do very much for people who don't drive a car. And I think, you know, my testifier, Connor, here would even probably speak to this more eloquently than I can. And I'd love to have him talk to it because I think, like, I don't think we hear enough in this committee from people who don't drive a car. I can't drive a car.
Mr. Connors, would you like to add anything?
Yes. Thank you. Yes. We need, when it comes to forms of transportation, having at least one is critical. Otherwise, you, as I was mentioning, you can't live independently. That does mean that I need to be extremely careful with where it is that I live. There's certain places I can't. This would help with expanding that. And on the level of cost and meeting essential needs, this is an essential transportation need. Without it, not being able to live it independently is, there's, it's a loss. We also do need schools, but if we have to spend limited money, investing in the bicycle infrastructure is one of the most cost-effective ways to use limited funds. And as you're pointing out, we do need focus on essential needs, both school and transit. If we have to pick both and we have to meet both needs with limited funds, we should focus on the most cost-effective measures we can take.
Thank you, Mr. Connors. Representative Folgman.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Ream, I think Representative Myers touched on a little bit, but since the money is allocated already, as Chair Cagle mentioned, maybe it is something to look at to tailor it more to disabled and elderly instead of just anyone and everyone for anything.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ream, I just have a question for you. On line point 2.9 and 2.10, for a married taxpayer filing jointly, each spouse may apply to the commissioner separately, and the commissioner must issue each spouse a separate rebate certificate. So is it done by couple?
Representative Reed?
Thank you for that question, Representative Murphy. I might have nonpartisan staff explain that area better.
Mr. Burse?
Madam Chair and members, so the application process is, and the issuance of rebates is by individual, and what the department has indicated is that the issuance is to individuals and that each spouse could separately receive a rebate.
Madam Speaker?
Oh, I'll take that.
Madam Chair. You're welcome. just a follow-up
Murphy.
Question then.
Quickly, please.
It says must. Is that so? If they win the lottery, are they obligated? Does this couple expect they will each get a certificate?
Representative or Mr. Burse?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that might be a question for the department on their interpretation, but my reading of that is not that that the department has an affirmative requirement of issuing the certificates to both if one applies, rather that the must is in reference to a multiple separate issuances if all the requirements are met for that applicant.
Thank you, Mr. Burson. Are you looking at the A1 amendment?
No, I'm looking at the A1 amendment, I'm sorry, yeah. Madam Chair?
We have other members on the list. We really need to move on, so.
I'm not done.
Well, we've got to move on. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I just want to say is, I know there's discussion about whether this program is the right program, and that's for a different bill. And I hope to folks on the other side that what Representative Ream is doing is We have something that's midway through, it's appropriated, and trying to make improvements to an existing program. We can debate later whether we should cut the program, and I imagine we're going to have all kinds of very difficult budget decisions, and many worthwhile things are going to get impacted. But this is how we going to improve something that's midstream. And so I'd take it at that level. I appreciate you bringing this. There was a comment about disability folks. I think that's a great thing to investigate. I do think I understand that sometimes it can be tough for someone with a disability to figure out how to approve that, to prove that to folks, sort of how to implement that kind of a thing. But I think that's interesting feedback for maybe for you to take. Thanks.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would say that especially among people who are neurodiverse, who have invisible disabilities, it's really hard to get a diagnosis sometimes. So if we were to limit it to people who are have a certain diagnosis of a disability, I think, especially when we're looking at a program that would benefit young adults, I think I wouldn't want to do that because I think that would make this program less accessible to people who are disabled but don't have, don't have that diagnosis. And as we've heard, e-bikes are not a luxury item for many of our residents here in Minnesota and throughout the world. For people who cannot afford a car or maybe disabled and cannot drive a car or who choose to, use an alternate mode of transportation, e-bikes are a great alternative. So I would very much appreciate it if you'd consider this bill and keep this all in mind.
They'll have more folks on the list.
Sorry, I thought we were closing.
Okay, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask the question that Representative Murphy didn't have an opportunity to ask, but for the sake of time, I've got a different point here. You made a comment to Representative Fogelman about the fact that this money has already been appropriated. Now, I think it's inappropriate to identify saying that, well, because we've already said we're going to buy Christmas presents in December, when something pops up like a looming $6 billion deficit, that we still have to keep that allocation towards Christmas presents in December. This is not anywhere near what we need to do. $2 million appropriated does not mean we can't take it back and say there are other more responsible ways of spending these funds. So the money's not spent. If the money was spent, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Because it's appropriated, that doesn't mean we can't, as a body, take that and spend it in a more wise place.
Representative Koznick.
I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Ream, now you can close.
Thank you for this robust discussion. I appreciate you considering all the aspects of this bill. I think we are making this incredibly popular e-bike rebate program more accessible. And I guess I'll just leave it at that. I think the testifiers have done a great job explaining why this is an important tool when we're looking at ways to get around. And I very much appreciate you listening to us and would appreciate your vote.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Ream renews her motion that House File 2294 as amended, 2249 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. Next up on the agenda is Representative Tapke.
Thank you so
much. All right, Representative Tapke, if you would like to introduce your bill 1335 for another possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I make a motion that we have introduced House File 1335 for possible inclusion in the future Onwards bill and future finance bill. And I also have an author's amendment, A1, that I'd like to, in interest of time, just incorporate now. So I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Tapke moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. All right, Representative Tapke, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members and Chair Koznick. House File 1335 is a bill that we worked on last session for digital IDs. And so what this is the ability to have a driver's license or other ID on your phone. And so this isn't, you don't have to ever hand your phone over to anybody. You don't ever have to give up and we spelled that out very clearly in the A1 amendment. But you never have to hand your phone over to anyone. What this is just a tap method like Apple Pay or Google Pay. And so the people who want to would be able to have a license, an ID in their phone. And so the purposes of this would be simply for safety and for convenience and for protecting your privacy. And so I know there are concerns about privacy anytime we get into devices and digital IDs. And so we'll have a variety of folks here to talk about that today. But this would work just as if anybody has Apple Pay or Google Pay on their phone. It would work as a tap just like that, or the chip on your credit card, that kind of thing. So you wouldn't ever have to give over your device. And Madam Chair, I have a testifier here from Shakopee to chat about the importance of the bill.
Thank you. Are you Jesse Laura?
Yes. Yes, I am.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jesse Laura. I'm from Shakopee. I'm here today to support the authorization of electronic driver's licenses in Minnesota. Comes down to three things: convenience and accessibility, enhanced security and fraud protection, and modernization of government services. I think the most immediate and relatable benefit for Minnesotans is the convenience and accessibility. I can't tell you how many times I have left my house without my wallet and realized I didn't have my ID on me, or I already use Apple Pay, so another layer of identification makes it that much easier. Being able to use it through the airport definitely would have saved me time when I had lost my ID through TSA once. I think digital IDs are going to be more secure than physical IDs due to encryption and compliance with strict AAMVA standards. They're going to reduce the identity theft risks. So let's say I lost my wallet. I still have my ID on my phone so I can carry on with life. And they're going to be less likely to be forged like a physical ID. Lastly, for modernization, nearly two dozen states have already adopted or are working on digital IDs. So let's bring Minnesota up with them.
Thank you very much. We also have Director Zhang on the list, if you'd like to come up to the rostrum. Director Zhang.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. And I want to say thank you to Madam Chair Cagle and Rep. Tapke for the opportunity to testify on HF 1335. The governor and DVS support efficiencies in government and providing services to customers in the way they prefer. This is why the governor recommended an online renewal option for DLs in the DVS budget. Similarly, a mobile ID or MDLs, as we call it in the AMVA world, provide an opportunity for customers who want the option to store their driver's license or ID card securely in their phone. 12 states already offer an identity document that can be used by TSA, and many, many more are looking to pursue that option throughout the country. MDLs allow for an individual to present their ID and exchange only the necessary information. I think that's really one of the cornerstones of the MDL and why it's more secure than handing over your full credential. DVS and our contractor, FAS, have had multiple discussions regarding mobile ID, and we're confident that the MinDrive system is capable of accommodating this into our system, and FAS has already delivered this project in other states. We appreciate Rep. Tapke bringing this to this initiative forward, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. And you have another testifier up there with you, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Lohmeyer. I am the project manager for FAST Enterprises, maintaining the MinDrive system for DPS. I'm here today to help explain some of the technical aspects of the mobile ID infrastructure and answer any questions around that. Particularly here today to help explain how the mobile ID process is more secure than identifying yourself with a physical ID. One thing that comes to mind is when you are identifying yourself for an age-restricted purchase, or maybe you're going to a bar and you need to identify your age. Handing over a physical credential today hands over all of your private data, your address, your name, date of birth, height, weight, everything. Within the mobile ID infrastructure, it's designed in a way that when you share your identity, only the data that is necessary for that interaction is shared with the identifier. So, for example, if I'm trying to enter a bar, the person that's trying to identify me only needs to be able to compare DVS's photo with me and know that I'm 21. They don't need to know what my date of birth is specifically, and the mobile ID infrastructure allows for that in both a safe and secure way. It also is secure from, data breaches in a way that only the data is stored on the device and encrypted. And in any interaction within the mobile ID infrastructure, be it the sign-up process, the vetting of the mobile ID request at the agency, or sharing the data, all data is end-to-end encrypted and kept safe from any sort of breach in that way. This process was put together through industry experts at the International Standards Organization. I believe the bill does mention the standard. And that standard had five guiding principles. It is secure by design. The user maintains control of their data, and they consent to only the data that they want to share. It is unlinkable and untraceable. The relying parties, or those who are identifying somebody, can trust the data, as that data is cryptographically signed by the agency, so they know that data came from DVS in this case. And we are able to improve the data freshness of the identifying information as that data is refreshed on the device in regular intervals. I'm happy to take any questions, and I'll be here for follow-up.
Thank you very much. I'm assuming Mr. Neumeister, are you wanting to testify?
Mr. Neumeister, always great.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. First, let me apologize for coming in and out. As you know, these are unique calls. I had to be two places at once where I wore my open government hat. Now I'm here wearing my privacy hat. This bill, I think, is not ready for prime time and needs lots of work from a privacy perspective. One of the first questions that I'd ask, because I helped develop CrimNet, that all of you are familiar with, where criminal justice information is shared. I sat on that governing committee for 22 years as a public person on privacy. And we asked for, what is the privacy impact statement? Is there a privacy impact statement on this new dynamic that lays out what the questions are, what are the issues, so that you as policymakers can deal with? Secondly, some of the issues that I just highlight is there is centralized tracking and data sharing. Depending on the software, DPS could be having elements of data of where you were and what. Again, depending on how it's implemented and the software that you use. Then that comes to the second part that this dynamic does not have. Like I told you about, the CrimNet group was made up of all people, state people and all that. There should be a work group with this, involving advocates, community people, and the users and the impact. So that's another item that this does not have. Should forbid any party from requiring, you know, to where these, you have to show these dynamics. There are other things, and I probably only got about a minute or two, and I just want to wrap up by saying different parts of the bill. When you look at on page 2, line 24, where electronic credential data is subject to Chapter 13, are you telling the bar owner who is verifying, all of a sudden you're going to be under Chapter 13? Because there might be some data elements, I'd like to see it deleted. So in summary, as the old saying goes, the legislature needs to put good policy. And we all know bad laws are made when there's not broadly good information given to policymakers. This one needs a lot of good information and a lot of broad discussion. So Madam Chair, members of the committee, Those are my comments. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Looks like we have one other testifier. If you'd like to come up to the rostrum, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the Legislative and Policy Director at Citizens Council for Health Freedom, a national nonprofit health policy organization based right here in St. Paul. For over 25 years, our mission has been to protect patient and doctor freedom. CCHF opposes House File 1335 because any shift towards digital IDs significantly expands government power over individual lives, including in healthcare, and threatens personal privacy, security, and autonomy. While we understand that the bill as currently drafted makes a digital ID voluntary, the goal is to make digital IDs the only option. But don't take our word for it. Roughly a year ago, in testimony to Congress, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, also known as AMVA, stated, quote, "While AMVA anticipates the MDL will eventually be used as a singular identity credential, we recognize for the immediate future, both the physical card and the MDL must coexist." It is not just our organization's belief that a digital ID, if implemented, would become the only ID. It's AMVA's belief, too. House File 1335 references compliance with roughly 200 pages of AMVA standards on lines 1.17 and 1.20. Then on lines 2.7 and 2.20, the bill references compliance with, quote, applicable AMVA standards. Does this mean Minnesota would be bound to whatever standards AMVA decides now and in the future? And what happens if the AMVA standards change to require digital IDs? What if AMVA decides as part of the licensing process that states should collect additional biometric data, which is more easily stored and connected to a digital ID than on a physical ID card? On AMVA's website, they state, quote, "There is a real possibility that biometric data may one day replace or supplement existing identification," end quote. They define that biometric data as fingerprints, facial geometry, iris, blood vessel pattern in the retina, voice, signature, etc. As a health freedom and privacy organization, this is of significant concern to us. CCHF advocates for patient privacy rights because he who holds the data makes the rules. Privacy rights protect personal control and individual freedom. Despite intentions otherwise, digital IDs could very well eliminate privacy rights and create a no-cards, no-care system within healthcare and beyond. According to the AMVA Mobile Driver's License Implementation Guidelines mentioned in the bill on lines 1.16 to 1.18, quote, "As per design, the issuing authority is involved in real time each time an MDL is used by the MDL holder. The issuing authority would technically be able to keep track of when an MDL holder uses his or her MDL and keep track of what data is shared. Based on IP address analysis, the issuing authority would also be able to track an MDL holder's physical location to some extent," end quote. Thus, using a digital ID would catalog a person's behavior patterns, personal decisions, locations, and actions. For example, that audit log would show when a person showed their digital ID to go to the hospital or clinic, pick up prescriptions, purchase a gun, purchase alcohol or tobacco, board a plane, and more. Also within AMVA's guidelines referenced on lines 1.16 through 1.18 is the ability to send a push notification to delete or suspend a mobile driver's license from a device. Pennsylvania reported similar capabilities, including the ability to wirelessly pull up a driver's identification without having to leave their patrol cars. If a digital license can be remotely accessed as described, beyond concerns of misuse or privacy concerns of government tracking, would it not also leave an individual vulnerable to criminals or hackers who will inevitably seek to access this sensitive biometric data on an individual? Finally, on line 1.18, this bill would require compliance with an ISO standard that doesn't currently exist. When I looked this morning, the ISO standard says it is not currently available and it's under review. In conclusion, this bill is about more than just being able to have an ID on your phone as a matter of convenience. It is a calculated step to offer voluntary convenience now to enable future mandatory compliance. Thus, we ask you to oppose House File 1335 to protect the health freedom and freedom in general of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other members of the public that wish to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Tabke, for bringing this interesting concept that I'm an author on as well. When we first had this discussion, we looked at an old fiscal note that I think was a little bit off because they were talking about the utilization and the purchasing of furniture and office supplies. So I think that that's a concern that I have, is we don't have any idea what the current cost, because I didn't really trust the original one. But one of the comments that I asked you was, how is this alleviating other people with this electronic device? I'm seeing that with the DE or with the amendment we've got, we're still requiring individuals to have their actual license on them in nearly every case. And so in order to drive, you have to have your physical license. It also talks about anyone who's inspecting, verifying, or accepting electronic credentials must also provide the physical one as well. So I guess that's a different one. They can't choose between them. But other than purchasing alcohol, I'm confused what other things I would be able to use this for, other than, because I still have to have it to drive.
Representative Tabke.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Olson. So, yeah, those are both really good questions. First, on the fiscal note side of things, we haven't gotten the fiscal note back yet. And so the previous fiscal note, I am told that it is that since FAST has gotten more information as to how this would be implemented, where this would go, the current fiscal note, when it is finally released, is significantly less than where we're at right now. So that's good. And the finance and the money comes from the DVS special services account. So this is not general fund money. This is not ongoing money forever. This is making sure that we are able to implement this and move this forward now. And so that's the fiscal note side of things. And so this, as we have talked about privacy and those types of things, this bill does need a stop in judiciary. And so with that, would love to send it to judiciary today if that would be possible, and then make sure that it comes back here and would be included if it wanted to for the final fiscal bill that we have for transportation. So on the fiscal note side of things, that's where we're at on this. But then on the other side, as to use of this, is it, I think it's really important that we never require, and so that's why the A1 amendment was here. I think it's really important that we never require that using a digital ID is the only way you can do it, because there are lots of folks who don't have phones, don't want to have phones, that are capable of this. So I think that's a major way forward. So this bill specifically outlines that that a digital ID is not the only way that you can use it. And so in the meantime, until people get used to being able to, where retailers, where other folks are able to utilize digital ID. So right now there are 14 other states that currently are using digital IDs, and there are next to no problems that I've been able to find with those things, where things have been abused or problematic. It has gone really, really well. And so there are 14 other states to use it. You can use it at TSA, you can use it wherever, in a lot of different places. But if you wanted to use it at your local, you know, liquor store, I don't want to make sure, I don't want to force that liquor store to have the infrastructure to accept a digital ID. And so that's why it's important that you have a physical ID along with it, and that requirement for a physical ID could go away in the future. But for right now, it's really important that we make sure that everyone is able to be successful and use it if they want to, that everyone has flexibility and the ability to use this technology if and only if they choose to.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Wilson? Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Cagle and Representative Tabke. Thank you for bringing this bill. I'm thrilled to be an author on here as well and have signed on. So I have one comment and then a question I wanted to just say. You know, we've heard from some testifiers and some discussion about that this would then force everybody to become digital. And I will just say, you know, we've had online banking for quite some time, and my mother still insists on going to get money from the bank with a deposit slip. And so that's still an option that's out there for her, and that's not going to change. And so I just wanted to give that comparison. And then my question is, would tech companies be able to access personal data with using digital ID? Is that a possibility for tech companies to have any access at all to personal data.
Looks like Representative Tapke is phoning a friend here.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Representative Green, this is will be much better answered by the technical folks on this side.
Thank you. If you want to just restate your name for the record and then answer Representative Green's question, please.
Joe Lohmeyer. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, tech companies should not be able to access the data as long as the ISO standards are followed. The process of obtaining a mobile ID requires you to go through a process on the phone, and that the data that then is transmitted to DVS to request the mobile ID is all encrypted end-to-end from the moment it leaves the phone, and it goes through whatever tech company's infrastructure and then makes it to DVS's infrastructure to be vetted as a correct mobile ID request. That is all end-to-end encrypted. And then similarly, when DVS would then provision the mobile ID back to the device, everything is encrypted. There is no need for a connection to the internet in order to present your mobile ID. That is a device-to-device protocol as it was established through the international standard. And so you can present your ID without any sort of data going out to the internet or being available outside of those two devices that are sharing the information.
Thank you. Any other follow-up?
No, just thank you very much for that.
All right, last person on the list, Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After hearing, I'm going to have, but after hearing all the violators today, it seems weird. It's like a confessional here. You know, I violated that. Well, I violated that one. I'm not there, so. I have a couple questions. One of them, how easy is it to make an e-license? Do I just sign up and do it? What is the crux of that?
Representative Tapke, or I'm sorry, what was your last name again?
Lohmeyer.
Mr. Lohmeyer, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. It can depend on the wallet provider who's providing the app that is on the phone. Typically what you would see, again, just following the standard, the person that's asking for the ID is required to first take a photo of both the front and back of their physical license. And then also they go through a series of device checks. The device would ask for a selfie, and then there's a liveness check process where they make sure that I didn't obtain a photo of somebody and I'm just holding my phone up to the photo of that person. So the device may ask you to wink, may ask you to turn left or right or smile, something to make sure that it's a live person that is making the request for the mobile ID. That data is all packaged up and then vetted through a process that is defined by the agency. In this case, it would be DVS. Photo validation would be done make sure that all the data from the person matches the data on the driver's license that photos were taken of.
Very quickly, Representative Scraba.
So is there an opportunity in that point for someone's hacking? Are you vulnerable then? And then the other question that I need to ask before we go away, is this blockchain technology? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lohmeyer?
Madam Chair,
sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is not using blockchain technology. And the hacking possibility, again, through the app that is on the devices, the data is encrypted before it leaves the device. So there's no chance of interruption between the device and the agency when they're vetting the mobile ID application.
Thank you. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first heard about this in a conversation between Representative Doubt and Representative Hornstein in Hornstein's office. They were working on this together. Amazing. I do want to say one of the testifiers, I think from CCHF, made some pretty alarming claims about some things, and one of the things that was said was that it's based on a standard that doesn't exist. And I just did a quick search on that standard, the ISO IEC standard, and it does exist. So I would just caution us, if I can check that so quickly, caution us against some of that input we heard from that testifier.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Seeing, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know we're getting a little bit pressed for time. I did have some questions for the department, and I will ask them. But as they prepare, the biggest thing is that we don't have the fiscal cost. If we have time or we can pass, and we'll follow up on that. But, you know, we do have a $6 billion deficit looming. General funds, this is DVS, special funds, but it all can be manipulated, and I think, so I have concerns about spending additional dollars outside of our main charge. I will be interested in seeing what the fiscal cost is when that comes in. I am a little concerned being subject to the AA, MVA, and the ISO, IE. We should be deciding standards for ourselves. I'm wondering, Director Zhang, do you know if there's a cost to, it might be a little bit outside yours or Mr. Loma, you know, I'm concerned about if there's a cost to an entertainment or hospitality venue to be able to scan these readers, if they have to invest in other technology to be able to do what they do currently. But to Director Zhang, on your handout, and I wish I had more time to had reviewed it in advance, but it doesn't sound like you're particularly supportive or particularly opposed. I haven't said so explicitly, but it talks. One of the handouts talks about an audit log. With, again, the ISO standard recommends on a device an audit log. What is your position or concerns with an audit log if we did do and instituted a digital ID?
First off, maybe we could ask Mr. Lee about the fiscal note and when we may be able to expect that.
And then, Madam Chair, maybe what the previous fiscal note was, just to give us a ballpark as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, yes, I did request the fiscal note on the 4th of this month. It is usually due in 2 weeks, so it has not been turned in by the agency yet for LBO review. On the fiscal note from last year, that was on House File 4900, there was a $1.1 million special revenue fund cost in the first year and $847,000 cost in the next year.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. And then to Director Zhang, if you'd like to answer the question.
And maybe Madam Chair, just to clarify my question to the director, the audit trail, but I guess I'm more curious what your thoughts are on the fiscal note coming out of one of your funds.
Madam Chair and Rep. Kosnick, so as far as the audit log, AMBA has a recommendation to not either not allow an audit log or maintain the audit log in a way that only the customer can see it and control it, delete it, track it for their purposes. So that's the recommendation from the AMBA guidelines. Depending on how this bill is established as it's currently amended, we would follow that recommendation, which would give DVS the option to do either or. I think the idea here is that the customer controls it, whether if we allow it in the MDL. In terms of the fiscal note itself, we are working to update it. We want to make sure that the data is accurate. And we're just putting that together, and it should be really close to the prior fiscal note because the technology and the solutions is pretty much the same from the last time we looked at it.
Thank you, Director Zhang. And we have very little time, so if we could just have very quick question. Good?
Yeah, you can proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tapke, would you like to wrap up your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. So thank you, everybody, for the conversation on this. I just want to real quick tell a story that this weekend, or actually on Tuesday, my 18-year-old daughter went to her very first concert by herself. And so to get into that concert, she had to have ID check and got sweat. And so she has driver's license, and she had her driver's license scanned when she went in to make sure that she was 18 and able to be there. And this code back here, this barcode back here, gave that person who swiped her card access to her name, her address, her not her phone number, but her date of birth. It gave access to all of those things that person had complete and total access to. That venue had total access to that information that was contained on this driver's license. And so if she had digital ID, all she would have had to do is tap this, and it would have said she's good or she's not good to go in. And it would have had a it would have told that venue that she was able to go in. So this bill, in order to move forward, does need to stop at judiciary. Representative Chair Kosnick, are we okay to go to judiciary, or what do you? Okay, so I renew my motion. This gets laid over for possible future inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Your motion is renewed. Bill's laid over. Next up is Representative Jones. Discouraging that we're unable to move bills out of this committee. And so next up, Representative Jones, if you'd like to introduce 2505.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm excited to present this bill to provide more flexibility in state aid street design standards, allow cities and counties to meet local needs, and improve efficiencies. So Minnesota has two standards, the Trunk Highway Design Standard and the State Aid Design Standards. And those are for, the second parts are for municipal state aid streets, MSAS, and county state aid highways, CASA streets. No one really knows why we have two. but as I understand it, Minnesota is the only state to have separate state standards for state aid streets. I will want to note that as someone with an engineering background, I really value vetted design standards. So why am I bringing this bill? What problem are we trying to solve? Community members are asking for road designs with elements that are not currently allowed by current state design standards. This is happening across Minnesota. I've seen it. I've heard issues in my city of Minneapolis. I also have spoken to a woman in New Ulm who had this issue. These standards haven't been updated in 8 years, and there is no regular cadence for updates. A process, though, does exist to allow for locals to local governments to petition MnDOT for a variance. And there have the problem has been there's been recent variance determinations that have not made a lot of sense, and locals have had no recourse. The other thing problem is that variance processes take staff time and capacity, thus increasing costs, and it makes it more likely that only large cities can actually go through and pursue variances. So that's the problem. Moving to the solution, the proposed solution provides locals more options. Cities and counties with this bill may continue with their current design processes with existing state aid standards. They do not have to change anything with regard to how they design their roads. This policy only gives them more options. This bill gives a set of design standards that have been recognized and or funded by the Federal Highway Administration as alternatives that a local government may choose to utilize. This pre-approved list would reduce the number of necessary variances. The variety in this list ensures that there are fresh or more recently updated standards available, and fewer variances would lower costs for local governments and especially open up options for smaller cities that couldn't consider variances due to cost in the past. This also creates a more accountable variance process. It codifies an existing rule, rulemaking, and it does make alterations to that rulemaking through statute by including membership and reporting requirements. I've talked with my city and county, and they are supportive of the intent of this bill. You'll also see in the packet further support from cities. I've had conversations with stakeholders, and I recognize that there are some concerns. This is one strategy to address the issue that I've laid out here, and I'm more than willing to work with stakeholders to figure out a pathway to address concerns. I'm happy to bring up my testifiers.
Thank you very much. First on the agenda is Mike Mayo, council member from the city of Duluth. You on?
All right. Hello. Can you hear me?
Perfect. Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. So hello, everyone. Thank you, Chair. As mentioned, I'm here to speak on House File 2505. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm a Duluth City Councilor in District 2, Eastern Duluth, and I've been serving since 2022. I'm a board member of our local MPO, the Duluth Superior Metropolitan Interstate Council, since 2022. And my council committee has also been Public Works and Utilities since that year. I focused a large amount of my time on transportation-related issues since I came into office. And I just want to be clear that I'm not here today to speak necessarily on behalf of our staff, even though I've had discussions with many city staff in Duluth who are in alignment on this. But I'm here as a local elected official and transportation advocate who's seen how some of these standards have impacted our city projects. So the challenge of complying with stated standards has come up at many junctures of the road as we've had road improvements and safety projects here in Duluth. One of the specific examples I wanted to share today is West Skyline Parkway in Duluth, which is near Inger Tower and was designated as Minnesota Scenic Byway in 2001. So for those not familiar, the road is narrow. It winds through the entire city. And this specific section is used by hikers, bikers, and drivers alike because it's an amazing, beautiful scenic byway with vistas of the entire waterfront. During the pandemic, the outer section of this loop around Inger Tower that connects Skyline Parkway was closed and became a temporary pedestrian mall or multi-use walking and biking route. And over the past several years, since it did reopen, there have been numerous accidents along this corridor, resulting in several fatalities, including pedestrian fatalities. Duluthian Kenneth Bickle, who is 70 years old, died in February of 2024 after being struck by a car while he was walking this section of the parkway near Inger Park. And Logan Wook, who is 26, died earlier in February of 2024 after rolling his car in the same vicinity. So the design of this road and current state aid standards have limited our options for reconsideration. While our city staff did eventually arrive at a decision that would maintain a continuous two-way road, which is state aid standard, using the back portion of this roadway, our options were limited due to state aid standards. These options could have included a one-way loop for the entirety of the road around Inger, a pedestrian walkway similar to what we had during the pandemic, and many more options. By allowing for flexibility in the design, we are still complying with state road standards, but we can leave the possibility open for road designs that can be better reflect the needs of our community and save cities and counties time and resources that were previously spent trying to find solutions that meet sometimes stringent state aid standards. This also helps us approach these issues from a perspective that meets the needs of all of our community and build safer roads and usable roads for all people of all abilities and modalities. Lane widths, one-way consideration, and traffic calming efforts are all a part of this. And just another short example, just last week I was at a St. Louis County meeting, and they were dealing with a road study near an elementary school in Duluth. The idea of changing the speed limit for a part of the road was brought up, and the county's having to inquire with MnDOT about whether or not they can change this limit, just 5 miles per hour from 45 down to 40, which I've heard can sometimes take months to years to get a determination of whether or not this is allowed, even though it is a county road.
Can I ask so granting you to the ability wrap up to very quickly? We're running very short on time. Thank you.
Okay. Sounds great. So granting the ability would allow local people to make those decisions. So I ask that you please support HF 2505 and would like to thank the authors for bringing this forward today. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Next up on the agenda, we have Deborah Heiser. Again, we have very limited time. If we're not hearing, if the bills on the agenda today aren't heard, we will hear them on April 7th, the next time I have the gavel. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and be very quick with the testimony.
I will do my best. Deborah Heiser, I'm the engineering director for the City of St. Louis Park, but I'm here today as the president of the City Engineers Association of Minnesota. I'm going to be brief here. First and foremost, the state aid rules provide guidance and consistency across the state. These rules were created by the 87 counties and the 156 state aid cities. MnDOT is just the administrator. They're the people who make sure that we comply with them. We support the city engineers. We support 10-foot lanes. We support flexibility in design. But we recommend focusing our efforts on cleaning up the rules and not putting these in statute. We want the flexibility, bottom line. You could do this one of two ways. We could remove all references to constrained right-of-way. We could reconvene the Rules Committee, order the Commissioner to do that. Either alternative would provide the same result. There's a lot of things in the bill I'd like to talk about, but out of the respect for time,
Thank you.
I would love to meet with Representative Jones.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry we aren't able to give this the attention it needs, but hopefully we'll be able to. This is another one that we were hoping to move to GovOps, but it will be laid over. So we'll have more opportunities to talk about it. Alyssa Schoeman, is that, I'm assuming? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Schoeman. I'm the Director of Strategic Partnerships at Move Minnesota. Move Minnesota works for communities where everyone can get where they need to go, whether they walk, bike, take a bus or train, or drive. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill because it's a common sense bill that allows communities to implement proven solutions and ensure the guidance that they are held to is up to date with current standards. This bill gives communities the flexibility to design to their specific context while still adhering to nationally recognized standards, as they do with many other aspects of street design already, such as with the Manual for Uniform Traffic Control Devices. This bill impacts the entire state of Minnesota. Every county in the state has roads and projects that have received county state aid or municipal state aid funds, and giving them the option to follow nationally recognized standards simply gives them more tools in their toolboxes. Adhering to nationally recognized standards is what every other state in the country is already doing. We are the only state that has state aid laws like this that put duplicative compliance layers on top of national standards, which our communities prove time and time again they are more than capable of following. Over the last decade, through my work as a transportation advocate and through Minnesota Safe Routes Network, I've seen hundreds of presentations and talked with hundreds of people working as planners and engineers. I've heard time and time again that state aid has its own rules, rules that aren't the same as the written planning guidance of MnDOT, and that communities don't even try to apply for variances for nationally recognized standards like raised crossings because they know state aid won't accept them. It's time to allow communities the flexibility to bring their planning standards up to date. I ask for your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have Sean Hayford O'Leary. State your name for the record and please proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and members. Sean Hayford O'Leary, I'm a city council member in Richfield, and I've also served on the school district Safe Route to School Committee for the last 6 years. City of Richfield is still working on their position on this bill, but I do want to just come here today and share my perspective on why I think this current system is broken and why I think this bill is really important. We have a state aid street that is in front of two elementary schools. Over the years, car traffic has increased to those schools from parent drop-off, and it became really unsafe for kids to walk and bike to school. Richfield worked for years, got external funding in part from the state to help rebuild that section of street to make it safer for kids to be able to walk and bike to school. They came up with a design that we knew would work with for school buses, would work for parent drop-off, and would keep kids walking and biking safer. It also met all current state aid standards. But when our staff went to state aid, presented their design, they were told they needed a variance to do something that is plainly allowed in state rules. They sought that variance, and the matter under dispute is this 10-foot lane width. They sought that variance under their instructions. They spent a lot of staff time and effort explaining exactly why it was justified, and that entire application was disregarded. Not only did they require a variance that wasn't required, they also ignored the contents of the application and failed to consider it fairly. Richfield's work with MnDOT and our own legislators to try to address this issue, but this is a widespread issue. Other cities, as Representative Jones mentioned, are simply not even applying for these variances because it just isn't worth the effort. This isn't how it should work. MnDOT is effectively changing rules on the fly. It has a chilling effect on cities trying to do important work, like making it safe for kids to walk and bike to school. It also affects timing and construction costs. This is a project we're trying to do this year. If we don't get this resolved, we are on the hook for making a less safe design that is going to cost us tens of thousands of dollars of unexpected money, or delaying the project and losing all the funding another year. The legislature should ensure that the state rules are being followed by state agencies and give cities flexibility to do designs that will protect kids and other residents. The process is being abused today, and it really needs reform, and I think this is a great way to address that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then last testifier, Joe Gustafson, if you could please keep your testimony very brief, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Gustafson. I'm the Washington County Traffic Engineer, and I'm here today as a member of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. Minnesota has long been and continues to be a national leader in roadway safety, in part thanks to our commitment to ongoing safety research and prudent standards for roadway design. Cities and counties that accept fuel tax funds for their primary roadways, that is, the roads that they choose to put on their state aid system, can use these funds for things like design, right-of-way acquisition, construction and maintenance, and in return must meet state aid design standards for lane width, shoulder width, bicycle lane dimensions, curvature, and weight capacity that have been established for these primary roadways. These are the corridors that typically carry higher volumes of traffic, including freight, transit, and school buses. Building lanes that are narrower than the vehicles using them is indeed a concern for many roadways, especially since there's typically zero buffer to opposing lanes, adjacent lanes, or bicycle lanes. Counties want to share our support for having state aid design standards, which provides a consistent and context-sensitive approach across jurisdictions throughout the state. These rules provide counties with a uniform, defensible standard and recognize the unique road conditions and circumstances that we face in Minnesota. House File 2505 seeks to make adherence to Minnesota's state aid rules optional, as long as a city or county adopts a different design standard. The bill provides a list of other national and international documents which, while informative, are rich in ideas and examples, are not in any way design standards in that they do not set any minimum thresholds. Currently, when an agency feels that an exception to stated design standard rules is warranted, the rules also establish a process to obtain a variance. These requests are reviewed by a committee that meets quarterly, consisting of city and county engineers and local elected officials. And since 2001, approximately 97% of requested variances have been granted, including several recent requests to utilize 10-foot lanes. Although the current rules provide flexibility to use 10-foot lanes in some situations without a variance, House File 2505 seeks to streamline the ability to use 10-foot lanes for more situations. Although 10-foot lanes aren't appropriate for all roadways, we do support improved clarity for where they can be implemented without a variance. Stated rules are periodically updated based on new research and evolving design practices, and we would welcome an initiative to provide improved clarity for where 10-foot lanes can be used without a variance. Finally, the bill also proposes major changes to the variance process, including requiring a much larger committee with more onerous reporting requirements, which appears to make it much more difficult to apply for and obtain a variance when needed, thus increasing the incentives for agencies to instead adopt one of the other listed documents that contain few or no actual design standards. Although its standards should evolve as new information becomes available. We believe the results of this bill, if passed in its current form, will serve to nullify state aid standards that have helped make Minnesota economically competitive, a destination for cycling, and a national leader in roadway safety. Thank you for the opportunity to share these concerns today. We look forward to continued conversations with Representative Jones, and I welcome any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we have 5 minutes. We've been allowed to stay here until 2:50. Is there any member questions? Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I notice in the bill that there's a new hire for a person to act as a liaison or whatever its person's role is. But my concern with the bill is after hearing both sides' testimony here, everyone's testimony, maybe it's an internal thing that needs to get done if we're looking for 10-foot roads. You know what I mean, when you start changing designs, it starts costing money. It's kind of the irony is I was looking at this, how it's going to cost us more money because we have a $6 billion deficit coming. And then you guys are saying we can save money by doing this, you know, and I'm torn. But I just think this seems to have more discussion for me. I apologize. Thank you. Bye.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Jones, would you like to wrap up your bill?
Thank you for the time. I'll leave it the rest.
Thank you very much. Representative Jones renews her motion that House File 2505 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, members, I do want to say that the next day I want to apologize to Representative Kraft and Representative Bakeberg, who was so patiently waiting here the entire time. We will be hearing 1817 and 1815 the next time I get the gavel. I also just am very disheartened that we are not able to get any of our legislation moved out of this committee. There has been 11 bills moved since power sharing went into agreement, and one of them has been a DFL bill. And so I would hope that we could have a little bit more cooperation when it comes to getting these bills through, because it's going to take all of us to get a budget bill passed. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.